Welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Byron Buckner, bringing you an hour of news, history, commentary, and information about the African American community. This week I'll have three readings about Juneteenth from the Dallas Morning News and Texas Monthly Magazine. I'll have two readings about hair from the Associated Press and the website 2190.com. And I'm starting with an obituary from The Hollywood Reporter. The title is, Sly Stone, Funk Rock Pioneer Dies at 82. This was published June 9, 2025 in The Hollywood Reporter and written by Roy Traken. Sly Stone, who took audiences higher during memorable performances at Woodstock and the Fillmore West, but whose career was plagued by drug problems and periodic disappearances, has died. He was 82. Stone died after a prolonged battle with COPD and other underlying health issues, his family said Monday, June 9th. It is with profound sadness that we announce the passing of our beloved dad, Sly Stone of Sly and the Family Stone, they wrote in a statement. Sly passed away peacefully surrounded by his three children, his closest friend, and his extended family. While we mourn his absence, we take solace in knowing that his extraordinary musical legacy will continue to resonate and inspire for generations to come. Sly and the Family Stone burst onto the scene in 1968 with the cathartic Dance to the Music, and followed with a string of crossover smash hits that defined their hometown San Francisco's Summer of Love, including Stand, Hot Fun in the Summertime, Running Away, If You Want Me to Stay, and Time for Living. The band was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1993 and inspired everyone from Herbie Hancock to George Clinton's P-Funk, Michael Jackson, Curtis Mayfield, Bob Marley, the Isley Brothers, Prince, Public Enemy, Red Hot Chili Peppers, the Black Eyed Peas, The Roots, Outkast, and Kendrick Lamar. Stone's life was a subject of significant discussion this year thanks to Questlove's documentary, Sly Lives, which was released to significant acclaim earlier this year. Sly was a monumental figure, a groundbreaking innovator, and a true pioneer who redefined the landscape of pop, funk, and rock music, Sly's family said. His iconic songs have left an indelible mark on the world, and his influence remains undeniable. In a statement to his enduring creative spirit, Sly recently completed the screenplay for his life story, a project we are eager to share with the world in due course, which follows a memoir published in 2024. Born on March 15, 1943 in Denton, Texas, Sylvester Stewart came from a family of devout Christians who took their beliefs with them when they moved to Vallejo, California, a suburb northwest of San Francisco. Reared on church music, he was eight when he and three of his siblings recorded a gospel single as The Stewart Four. A musical prodigy who picked up the name Sly in grade school, Stone was adept at keyboards, guitar, bass, and drums by 11, and he went on to perform in several high school bands, one of which, the Viscanes, boasted a then unheard of mixed lineup and released a few singles. After attending Vallejo Junior College, Stone got a job as a fast-talking DJ at San Francisco R&B station KSOL, where his eclectic taste stoked his popularity, working the new British bands like the Beatles, the Animals, and the Stones into the station's soul format. By the time he brought his show to Crosstown KDIA, he had already been producing records for the local label Autumn Records thanks to DJ Tom Donahue, who recommended him. The company was the home for such Bay Area bands as the Bo Brummels, the Charlatans, the Great Society, and the Mojo Men. In 1964, Stone produced Bobby Freeman's top five pop hit, Come On and Swim. After leading a band called Sly and the Stoners, featuring trumpet player Cynthia Robinson, Stone brought in his brother Freddie on guitar, Sister Rose on keyboards, Greg Errico on drums, Jerry Martini on sax, and Larry Graham on bass to complete Sly and the Family Stone. They drew the interest of Epic Records, where they signed and released their debut album, a whole new thing at the end of 1967's Summer of Love. Despite critical acclaim, A Whole New Thing failed to resonate with audiences. However, the subsequent re-release of a new single, Dance to the Music, from the album of the same name, vaulted into the top 10 on both the pop and R&B charts. Everyday People and its B-side, Sing a Simple Song, released in late 1968 and followed by the album Stand in May of 1969, marked the crossover emergence of the band, going to number one on both the pop and R&B charts, followed by the title track and its B-side, I Want to Take You Higher. The album climbed to number 3 R&B and number 13 pop, the band's first certified platinum seller, with iconic non-singles such as Sex Machine. There's a Riot Going On is arguably Stone's masterpiece, both critically and commercially. It went to the top of both the pop and R&B album charts within a few weeks of its release in November 1971. The transformative masterpiece of Race and Song, a template for the later work of Kanye West and Kendrick Lamar, among others, the album was inducted into the Grammy Hall of Fame in 1999. That turned out to be Sly's last hurrah. In June 1973, the band released a new single, If You Want Me to Stay. The departures of Graham and Errico during this period hastened the band's demise. Continuing with Epic, Sly recorded High on You in 1975 and Heard You Missed Me, Well, I'm Back a year later. In June 1983, Stone was arrested in Fort Myers, Florida and charged with cocaine possession. He toured with Bobby Womack, recorded with Jesse Johnson and released several songs from soundtracks including Ikaboo Static Automatic for Soul Man, produced in 1986, and I'm the Burglar for Burglar in 1987. Stone's sightings were sporadic after that, though he did appear for his Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction and at the 2006 Grammys, where he briefly and bizarrely participated in a multi-artist tribute to the band featuring John Legend, Fantasia, Adam Levine, Ciara, Steve Tyler, and Joe Perry. He abruptly waved goodbye midway through I Want to Take You Higher, disappearing into the night. Sly Stone is survived by a son, Sylvester Jr., from his first wife, Kathy Silva, and two daughters, Sylvette, whose mom is Robinson, and Novena Carmel. We extend our deepest gratitude for the outpouring of love and prayers during this difficult time. We wish peace and harmony to all who were touched by Sly's life and his iconic music, his family said. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your unwavering support. That was the obituary of Sylvester Stewart, titled Sly Stone, Funk Rock Pioneer Dies at 82. It was written by Roy Traken and published June 9, 2025 in The Hollywood Reporter. My first reading about Juneteenth is out of Fort Worth, Texas, and is about the individual that led to the recognition of Juneteenth as a national holiday. The title is Opal Lee on Road to Recovery. This was written by Chase Rogers and published in the Dallas Morning News newspaper on June 3, 2025. Opal Lee, a longtime Fort Worth civil rights leader known as the grandmother of Juneteenth, was hospitalized late last month when visiting Ohio to mark the 30th anniversary of the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center in Cincinnati, her family confirmed Sunday. Lee is still unstoppable despite her hospitalization, according to a weekend news release from local nonprofit Unity Unlimited Incorporated, run by Lee's granddaughter. The 98-year-old is now recovering from her hospital stay and looking forward to returning home to Texas, the release said. The National Underground Railroad Freedom Center did not respond to an inquiry seeking additional information Sunday afternoon. Lee was scheduled to attend the center's annual International Freedom Conductor Awards program on May 24th. Her granddaughter, Dion Sims, said Lee could not attend due to her hospitalization. The event also honored Toni Morrison, the late Nobel Prize-winning author, Isabel Wilkerson, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author, and Lonnie G. Bunch III, the founding director of the National Museum of African American History and Culture and the current secretary of the Smithsonian Institution. Lee is known as one of the most vocal advocates for the national recognition of Juneteenth. The June 19th holiday commemorates the end of slavery in the United States, marking the day Union troops arrived in Galveston to inform enslaved people they were free. Lee was born in 1926 in Marshall, Texas. Her family is from Cotton Valley, Louisiana. Her family moved to Fort Worth when she was 10. Lee holds bachelor's degrees in elementary education and a master's in counseling and guidance. She retired from working as an educator and counselor. She also is a mother of four children. Lee began advocating for federal recognition of Juneteenth when she was 86. In 2016, she drew national attention when the then 89-year-old traveled from Fort Worth to Washington, D.C., walking 2.5 miles in several cities along the way, a more than 1,400-mile route as part of the effort. Lee often leads the annual walk in Fort Worth, though last year's walk was held in Dallas. The 2.5-mile walk symbolizes the 2.5 years it took for news of the Emancipation Proclamation to reach enslaved people in Galveston. Before becoming a federal holiday, Juneteenth had been a state holiday in Texas for over 4 decades. It has long been celebrated and recognized by black communities, including in East Texas, where Lee is from. It took nearly 10 years before Lee's mission was accomplished. And in 2021, former President Joe Biden signed a law making Juneteenth a federal holiday. That was the article, Opal Lee on Road to Recovery. It was written by Chase Rogers and was published in the Dallas Morning News newspaper on June 3, 2025. My next reading is from Texas Monthly Magazine and its texasmonthly.com website. The title is, The Story We've Been Told About Juneteenth is Wrong. It was written by Peniel Joseph, and it appeared in the magazine's June 2023 edition. The subtitle to the story is, The Real History is Much Messier and More Inspiring. My first memories of Juneteenth began in church. I grew up in a predominantly black section of Jamaica in the New York City borough of Queens. Our small congregation at New Bethel Baptist Church consisted of Caribbean immigrants such as my Haitian-born mother, native-born New Yorkers such as me, and migrants from across the South, including Texas. As new parishioners arrived, they transplanted their food, culture, and folkways into our church rituals and traditions. My mother prided herself in the excellence of her Haitian cooking, especially dishes such as soup jamu, stewed chicken accompanied by rice and beans, black or red, and sweet coconut dessert she occasionally prepared for other congregants. But we also relished those special occasions at church when the cozy upstairs room that doubled as a kind of banquet hall was filled with the rich aroma of Southern soul food, cornbread, fried fish, red velvet cake. This was the early 80s in my elementary school years. One Sunday morning as I sat on a light brown pew in New Bethel Sanctuary, I was rapt as parishioners from Texas took to the pulpit and told a fascinating story of enslaved Africans who didn't hear news of their liberation until Union General Gordon Granger issued an order in Galveston on June 19, 1865, more than 2 months after Confederate General Robert E. Lee's surrender at Appomattox Courthouse in Virginia. I was reminded of my mother's stories about the Haitian Revolution in which slaves overthrew French rule and, to much of the world's surprise, achieved independence in 1804. That uprising inspired emancipation movements around the globe, though it would be another 6 decades before freedom for the enslaved reached America's shores. After the service, I overheard fervent conversations about slavery and the need to teach young people like me to never forget. I didn't know it at the time, but my experience of hearing about Juneteenth was similar to that of untold others across the United States. Juneteenth had been observed in Texas since 1866, and celebrations soon spread to neighboring states. As black Southerners fled north and west throughout the 20th century in what became known as the Great Migration, festivities cropped up across the country. My family didn't mark Juneteenth at home, but our Texas parishioners never allowed us to take for granted its special meaning. Each year we would commemorate the day, often during a Sunday service and occasionally during vacation Bible school. Only later would I learn that the stories of Juneteenth that I'd heard in church were part of a far more complicated tale. I vividly recall watching the Roots television miniseries, which offered a groundbreaking examination of slavery in American popular culture. Juneteenth introduced a new layer to this story. I imagine myself as part of the Black Texas community, which dared to believe in dreams of freedom that were once considered impossible. As I grew older, my interest in history expanded. The more I found out, the deeper I yearned to go. Slowly, I came to realize that history was not just about the past. The stories it tells help us make sense of the here and now and might shape the future. I eventually became a professor, my teaching and research interests firmly planted in the 20th century civil rights and black power movements. In 2015, I accepted a position at the University of Texas at Austin, and once I arrived, my understanding of Juneteenth became more intimate. I witnessed local celebrations in Austin in which black Texans acknowledged the day's importance, but also wrestled with its contradictions, knowing that real freedom had not in fact been achieved that day in Galveston. It was still a work in progress. While Texans celebrated Juneteenth with particular zeal, many Americans still did not have the faintest clue about its origins, historical import, or contemporary resonance. That was until an improbable series of events transformed Juneteenth into a national symbol. George Floyd's public execution by former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin on May 25, 2020, sparked months of demonstrations that swelled into one of the largest social justice movements in American history and elicited an unprecedented collective outpouring of racial grief. Against this backdrop, I was one of many who began to examine Juneteenth anew. I published a CNN opinion article headlined, "Make Juneteenth a National Holiday Now," arguing in part that Juneteenth offers America a new origin story. Black people are largely absent from our national narratives. Juneteenth, I suggested, offered an opportunity to correct that. In some ways, Juneteenth can be read as a response to Frederick Douglass's searing 1852 speech in Rochester, New York, known as "What to the Slave is the Fourth of July." Douglass, a formerly enslaved black man from Maryland who became arguably the most important activist of the 19th century, assailed celebrations of freedom in a land scarred by slavery. "This 4th of July is yours, not mine," he said to the audience. "You may rejoice. I must mourn." On June 17, 2021, roughly a year after Floyd's killing, Juneteenth became an official U.S. holiday signed into law by President Joe Biden. It was the first new federal holiday since Martin Luther King Jr. Day was enshrined in 1983, and a signal achievement in American history, drawing the country one step closer to publicly acknowledging its original sin of slavery. Yet the real history of Juneteenth remains largely unknown. The myriad ways in which black freedom was persistently sabotaged, beginning with Granger's original order and continuing through today, at a moment when our national narrative is hotly contested. The teaching of history is under attack, which lends more urgency to an earnest reckoning with the meaning of Juneteenth. What are we celebrating when we observe it, and should we be celebrating it at all? Is it actually an indictment of America, a repudiation of the 4th of July? Is it a day worthy of veneration, of shame, or of both? When General Granger first sailed into Galveston in June 1865, he was accompanied by roughly 2,000 troops. At the time, Galveston was the most populous city in Texas, with a bustling and lucrative port managed partly by black workers who transported goods and gossip from around the world. Granger and his staff commandeered a villa in town and set up the impossible mission of bringing a semblance of order and security to the largest secession state of the newly restored Union. The mood was dark, with cities and rural hamlets still reeling from the physical and economic devastation wrought by the war. About a month earlier, the Confederate Army had won a battle at Palmetto Ranch outside Brownsville. That clash, the last major action of the Civil War, had been waged more than a month after Lee's surrender in Virginia. Without the forceful appearance of Union soldiers, black Texans had remained imprisoned within the convulsive clutches of a dying Confederacy. The stories of how General Order No. 3 was relayed to Galvestonians vary, but Granger likely read the order aloud in a public meeting designed to spread the message to as many people as possible. The words, "All slaves are free," served as a declaration of independence for some and a provocation to others. Granger and his troops often encountered a violent, anxious, fearful, and vengeful white population, including Confederate soldiers and sympathizers who engaged in reckless acts and looting in parts of Texas. Granger's order was based loosely on Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. The 13th Amendment, which made slavery unconstitutional, wasn't ratified until December 6, 1865. The order first declared that the formerly enslaved were free based on absolute equality of personal rights and rights of property between black people and those who had presumed legal ownership of them. This is the happy news upon which most Juneteenth celebrations are based. It's also an oversimplified tale of what happened that day. A common view about Juneteenth in both black and white communities is that black folks in Galveston and around Texas were slow to hear or fully grasp the news about the Civil War end and the arrival of liberty. This is the story I was told in church, but that's not entirely true. Some portion of black Texans, especially those working in the port of Galveston, knew that the tide of the war had long ago turned in favor of Union troops. They'd also promptly caught wind of the Emancipation Proclamation from travelers disembarking from the wharves. Further, they'd likely heard what must have seemed to be fantastical tales of regiments of black soldiers in the Union Army. News of impending freedom had almost certainly reached other parts of Texas when enslaved African Americans from the Deep South were transported to the Lone Star State during the war. Texas was a haven for white slave owners fleeing Louisiana and other areas of the Confederacy being conquered by Union troops. But the news held little practical meaning so long as the state remained under Confederate control. The arrival of some 2,000 federal troops appeared to mark an end to white rule over black Texans. But Granger's order limited and undermined the very freedom that it promised. The relationship between former masters and the enslaved would now evolve into a vague contract between employers and hired labor. The freedmen were advised to remain quietly at their present homes and work for wages, read the order. But how could black Texans enjoy freedom while remaining on plantations? Would they be allowed to leave, travel, or reunite with loved ones? Were they forbidden from becoming entrepreneurs and landowners? Further, black men and women were warned not to flock to military posts. Since 1863, when black men were allowed to enlist in the Union Army, its military posts became beacons for freedom. The sight of blue uniforms liberating secessionist territories often meant the promise of food, clothing, and reading materials. Granger's warning that black Texans will not be supported in idleness on military posts or elsewhere was an admonishment, suggesting that they could not rely on federal troops, whether those Texans were seeking protection, searching for news about family and friends, looking for work, or in need of food. The troops were there to enforce liberation, but they would not necessarily support those trying to carve out a new life. This is why, even after Granger arrived, many black folks responded to the news of freedom cautiously, fearing reprisals. Yet as word spread, some did walk away from plantations. Others rejoiced, exulted, and stayed put while planning their next moves. Fears among black Texans were borne out. In the ensuing months, the beginning of the period that would become known as Reconstruction, racial violence spread. In one town, white Texans whipped dozens of formerly enslaved people who celebrated the news of emancipation too enthusiastically. White attacks against free black people ranged from verbal harassment and intimidation to physical assaults and even murder. Black Texans in Galveston and other parts of the state navigated a new landscape at times more dangerous and volatile than the one they'd left behind. The backlash of many white residents against the idea of black citizenship and dignity would become a normal feature of Texas political landscape, a legacy that persists today. Just as limitations on black freedom were baked into Granger's emancipation announcement, Racial discrimination became embedded in public policies that propagated unequal housing and employment opportunities, wealth gaps, educational and residential segregation, police brutality, and political disenfranchisement. Black codes in Texas and throughout the South prevented African Americans from voting, securing fair labor contracts, attending racially integrated public schools, or owning land. For many years after Granger's arrival in Galveston, freedom could not be publicly enjoyed in some parts of Texas, even on Juneteenth itself. On a chilly day this past fall, I arrived in Houston's Emancipation Park and joined Erica Thompson, an archivist and historian who serves as community liaison at the African American Library at the Gregory School, which once housed the first black school in the city. Thompson had agreed to show me around the park, which sits just south of downtown in Third Ward, long a center of the city's black community. Established in 1872, the park was among the oldest in Texas, created by formerly enslaved locals who wanted a place to commemorate Juneteenth. Though the inaugural celebrations were relatively small, today they are citywide affairs that feature appearances and speeches by elected officials, religious and civic leaders, and a who's who of black Houston. As Thompson and I walked the ground, she pointed to the abstract mosaic sculptures that honor four of the community leaders who raised money to purchase the 10 acres of land: the Reverend David Elias Dibble, Richard Allen, Richard Brock, and John Henry Yates. Located at the four corners of the park, the sculptures are the work of the local artist Reginald Adams. The park, Thompson explained, serves as a living memorial to generations gone by. It's also a repository of a story that is just beginning to receive its due. The founders of Emancipation Park were all born into bondage. As pastors, tradesmen, political leaders, husbands, and fathers, they helped make Houston a wellspring of black social, political, economic, and religious life in Texas. After emancipation, Richard Allen quickly became one of Houston's most important political leaders. A talented carpenter and architect, he served as an agent of the Freedmen's Bureau, as a voter's registration supervisor, and as an elected state representative. Allen designed Antioch Missionary Baptist Church, which was led by Jack Yates, who had become a minister and activist in the late 1860s. Yates also played a leading role in the founding of the Houston Baptist Academy, a precursor to Texas Southern University. A third sculpture in the park honors Richard Brock, who established a successful career as a blacksmith in Houston at a time when barriers to African Americans' entrepreneurship were almost impossibly high. He later helped found the St. Paul African Methodist Episcopal Church. Lastly, David Elias Dibble was a self-taught preacher and founder of a Freedmen's Methodist congregation, now called Trinity United Methodist Church. Dibble collaborated with the Freedmen's Bureau, which helped create a school within his church, and served as a trustee for the Gregory School. These four men and their contemporaries provided an incubator for educational advancement, cultivated tight-knit religious communities, and built a thriving political movement that propelled a number of formerly enslaved black Texans into positions of power that made them prominent figures within the racially integrated Republican Party. After exploring the park grounds, I went inside the cultural center and gazed upon gorgeous photographs of 19th and early 20th century black Houstonians. One image depicts a well-to-do family outside a tidy home. Another shows a group of some 30 women and men during a Juneteenth celebration in the late 1800s. They look both prosperous and circumspect, with some older men doffing their hats and younger women wearing white, exhibiting a kind of grace that racist stereotypes of the era insisted that black people could never possess. Studying these photos, I was struck by how much black Texans were able to achieve in the years immediately after the abolition of slavery. Their efforts paved the way for others. Fort Bend County, just southwest of Houston, became such a significant base of black political activism that unsympathetic white Texans characterized it as part of the Senegambian District, a mocking reference to a region of West Africa. Black residents served as district clerks, constables, justices of the peace, and county treasurers. The creation of Emancipation Park represented a belief in the power and promise of a new Texas, one in which black citizenship and dignity could be celebrated, even as full equality was still just a dream. That was the article, "The Story We've Been Told About Juneteenth Is Wrong." The real history is much messier and more inspiring. It was written by Peniel Joseph, and it appeared in the June 2023 edition of Texas Monthly Magazine and its texasmonthly.com website. I'm going to shift from Juneteenth to a couple of readings about hairstyles. The first is titled, "The Black Hair Industry Imports Products from China." Here's what tariffs mean for braids and wigs. This was written by Charlotte Crayman and published May 31st, 2025 at the Associated Press's AP.com website. Before the oppressive summer heat descends on Atlanta, therapist Brittany Sims usually gets her thick, curly hair braided at a salon to preserve her healthy mane. But it's more expensive this year, so she'll only pay for her teenage daughter and son to get their summer hairdos. Not having braided hair creates more of a hassle for everything, said Sims, who counts herself among the tens of millions of women that regularly spend on the black hair care industry. Now, she said, she has to go home and figure out what I'm going to do with my hair in the morning after I went to the gym and it's messed up with sweating and frizz. President Donald Trump's tariffs are driving up prices for products many black women consider essential, squeezing shoppers and stylists even more as they grapple with inflation and higher rents. Much of the synthetic braiding hair, human hair for extensions, wigs and weaves, styling tools, braiding gel, and other products is imported from or has packaging from China, which was subject to a combined 145% tariff in April. India also is a major global source of human hair. Many black women have hair types and workplace favorite styles that require careful attention, and they can spend hundreds of dollars at salons each month on extensions, weaves, wigs, and braids. The Associated Press spoke with several black hair industry experts, beauty supply store owners, and wholesale companies, as well as nearly two dozen black stylists and braiders, some of whom may have to raise prices even as business has slowed. On Thursday, a federal appeals court reinstated most of Trump's tariffs on imported goods after they were blocked the day before by a three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of International Trade. Earlier this month, the United States agreed to drop the 145% tax on goods imported from China to 30% while the two economic superpowers negotiate new trade agreements. Imports from other countries face baseline tariff rates of 10%. Regardless, the next few months are already shot for many items, said Marty Parker, a University of Georgia business professor and supply chain expert who worked in the hair care industry. The cost companies have been facing at ports are making their way down to consumers. Supply shortages are getting worse, and it's unclear what will happen if negotiations break down. Prices go up very fast and come down very slow, Parker said. Some stylists said they're seeing fewer clients because prices are going up for virtually everything. Atlanta stylists are paying more for hair from China. Atlanta stylist Yana Ellis, who also sells products like wigs, paid an extra $245 in shipping for 52 bundles of hair in March compared to 40 bundles in December. Ania Butler said her shipping costs for human hair more than doubled from February to May. And Deja Blackshear found in early May that a beauty supply store raised the cost of the kind of hair she's used for years by $100. The store owner said he may have to stop selling that brand of hair because it went up so much. Similarly, some wholesale hair stores have seen higher costs or are expecting them in the coming weeks. Even the typical $6 to $10 cost of a pack of synthetic hair has crept up. Blackshear doesn't want clients to bring hair because she likes to vet the quality. But if expenses continue to mount, she may have to raise her prices. It's going to be extremely difficult, she said, especially for clients who are having to make those hard decisions between, do I get my hair done or do I pay my bills? Janice Lowe, who runs Five Star Salon in a lower-income neighborhood southeast of Atlanta, has started asking clients to bring hair and is unable to purchase certain products. I'm falling behind on my obligations, she said. Consultants vary on how much prices will rise, when they'll go up, and for how long. And the full harm to stylists and consumers could be months away. The global black hair care industry was worth about $3.2 billion in 2023, according to Market.us. And black women spend 6 times more on hair care than other ethnicities. Stylists often purchase some harder-to-get professional products from door-to-door distributors that buy from wholesale companies or larger distributors that purchase directly from other countries. Lois seen some of her distributors vanish altogether, making it harder to get professional lines such as black-owned leading professional hair care brand Design Essentials, manufactured in Atlanta at McBride Research Laboratories. Design Essentials is trying to delay big price increases until 2026 or 2027 and may turn to layoffs or pause promotions to save money, said President Cornell McBride Jr. Most packaging plastics come from China, but ingredients can come from many places. Nobody wants to put it to the consumer, but the person who pays is the consumer in the end, McBride Jr. said. Hawa Kita and her mother usually charge customers between $160 and $250 for braiding at their shop, Eve's African Hair Braiding at College Park, southwest of Atlanta. Kita is determined to take losses because their customers can't afford the Atlanta prices, Kita said. The cost of a box of 100 packs of braiding hair from China went up for the first time in 2 years, from $250 to $300, Kita said. They order weekly, often multiple boxes. Some companies say they'll soon raise prices or run out of stock. Making customers happy is ultimately what will keep the business afloat, Kita said. She smiled as she recounted braiding a young woman's hair for her birthday with a style she suggested. When we finished, she gave me the biggest hug, and she was in here screaming and just yelling because she just really loved her hair, Kita said. For many black Americans, especially women, affording their hair care also means confronting unfavorable beauty standards. Georgia State University law professor Tanya Washington said recent discoveries about dangerous chemicals in synthetic hair and hair straightening products have sparked conversations among black women looking for hairstyles that don't require as much imported products. But embracing natural hairdos can be daunting for women like the soon-to-be lawyers and clerks Washington advises who face pressure to straighten their hair. That puts everyone who does not have organically naturally derived straight hair at a disadvantage in these spaces, she said. I think that a definition of professionalism that favors one phenotype, European phenotype, over all others is inappropriate. That was the article, The Black Hair Industry Imports Products from China. Here's what tariffs mean for braids and wigs. This was written by Charlotte Crayman and published May 31, 2025 at the Associated Press's AP.com website. Now I have a reading about natural hairstyles. This one is titled, Everything You Should Know About Dreads and Locks by Jasmine Kylene. This was published March 3, 2025 in the magazine titled 2190. The way black people style their hair carries deep historical and spiritual significance. With so many styles that have served as a form of self-expression, resistance, and empowerment, from elaborate braids to the modern-day afro, hair has always been a vital part of cultural identity and pride. Among the most celebrated black hairstyles are dreads and locks, which have become symbols of heritage and personal transformation. Far beyond fashion trends, they are deeply rooted in spirituality and a celebration of natural beauty. They are distinctive hairstyles with unique methods of formation. Here's what to know about dreads and locks. Locks are a type of hairstyle where hair is intentionally matted or twisted into rope-like strands. The process of creating locks varies, though the hair may be twisted, rolled, or palm rolled to encourage the locking process. Locks can vary in size from pencil-thin strands to large, thick ropes of hair. Locks are a natural, low-maintenance hairstyle, though they do require care to maintain their health and neatness. People with locks typically wash their hair regularly, separate the locks to prevent them from merging into one, and may retwist or restyle the locks as they grow. You can start your locks using different methods: palm rolling, interlocking, two-strand twist, or freeform. Locks carry a profound connection to Black identity. In many African and Afro-Caribbean cultures, they are a manifestation of spiritual beliefs and connection to roots. The hairstyle has been a symbol of resistance against Western beauty standards and a declaration of pride in natural, untamed beauty. Dreadlocks, or dreads, are a form of hairstyle where the hair mats and tangle over time, resulting in distinct rope-like locks. While they have roots in various cultures around the world, including ancient Egypt, India, and Africa, they became especially prominent during the Rastafarian movement in Jamaica. Unlike locks, dreadlocks form naturally without much intervention. Hair is left to mat over time without regular maintenance or styling. Some people start dreadlocks by simply not combing or brushing their hair, allowing it to lock up in sections over time. While dreadlocks and locks share similarities, dreadlocks denote a more organic, less maintained version of the style. They are a form of rebellion, particularly in the context of anti-colonial and anti-establishment movements. While both dreads and locks share the same general idea, here are their key differences. Dreads form organically, with little intervention from the wearer. People who wear dreads often allow the hair to lock on its own without frequent twisting or maintenance. Locks, on the other hand, are often intentionally styled and maintained. While locks do involve the natural locking process, people have to frequently twist, palm roll, or interlock them to encourage neatness and uniformity. People with locks tend to prioritize active care to maintain the style. Historically, dreadlocks are a symbol of resistance, where the style is a rejection of colonial influences and Western beauty standards. Locks are more associated with a sense of cultural preservation. In many African, Afro-Caribbean, and African-American communities, locks are a way of maintaining a connection to African ancestry and celebrating natural beauty. Dreads require minimal maintenance. The natural locking process takes place without interference. The style is more freeform and can sometimes have a more rugged appearance. Locks, on the other hand, require more upkeep. They include regular retwisting or rolling to maintain the structure of the locks and prevent them from merging into one. That was the article, Everything You Should Know About Dreads and Locks, written by Jasmine Kylene. This was published March 3, 2025, in the magazine titled 2190. My final reading about Juneteenth is a book review. The title of the book is On Juneteenth by Annette Gordon Reed. The title of the article is The Tangled Meaning of Juneteenth, written by Angela Ards. This appeared in the June 2021 edition of Texas Monthly Magazine. In the historic Black neighborhood where I grew up in Dallas, a parade would roll off the lot of New Mount Zion Baptist Church on June 19th or the Saturday closest to it, and wend its way through a community where many of the streets were named for institutions and people central to Black history: Oberlin and Ebony, Belafonte and Danridge, Bunch and Campanella. Neighborhood celebrities, entrepreneurs, student body presidents, and original homeowners, or pioneers as we called them, would ride like homecoming kings and queens atop convertibles. When the Juneteenth parade made it to Wendodale Park, we'd have dinner on the grounds featuring barbecue, sometimes a fish fry, and big red soda water. There would be 3-on-3 basketball tournaments under the pavilion, and in recent years, performances of African drumming and indigenous dance in the field near the creek. Homegrown success stories such as former Cowboys cornerback Everson Walls would be inducted into the Wall of Fame, a mahogany display case in the recreation center's front hall. It was always an intimate affair among folks we'd known our entire lives who were living out values that our ancestors taught. Faith and community, education and industriousness, and above all, joy. Growing up, though, I heard many people, relatives out west, recent transplants from up north, black elites eager to distance themselves from supposedly backward cousins, mock our parades and picnics as sad testimonials to being late and last. Juneteenth, a contraction of June 19th, commemorates the day in 1865 when Union General Gordon Granger arrived in Galveston, Texas to issue General Order No. 3, marking the end of slavery in the state. This happened 2.5 years after the Emancipation Proclamation and 2 months after Robert E. Lee surrendered. The modern-day naysayers understood that devious forces, Texas slave owners dodging President Lincoln's order, had delayed the news of freedom. They just wondered why anyone would celebrate the fact that black Texans were the last to know. The answer, as the historian Annette Gordon Reed explains in her new book, On Juneteenth, is that Juneteenth was never about commemorating a delayed proclamation, but about celebrating a people's enduring spirit before and after General Granger's decree. My grandfather, an East Texas sharecropper born 2 generations out of slavery, is said to have celebrated no other holiday all year long. He and his contemporaries were remembering the emancipation of people they actually knew and refused to forget. Over its 156-year history, Juneteenth's popularity has waxed and waned. Throughout Reconstruction, black Texans held massive outdoor celebrations such as those at Maxima's Booker T. Washington Park, also known as Comanche Crossing. The entrenchment of Jim Crow in the early 20th century drove many of those gatherings into more private spaces, backyard barbecues and church ground picnics. Yet as black Texans migrated out of cotton fields and headed for cities like Dallas, Oakland, and Detroit, they took their big happy Juneteenth celebrations with them. During the civil rights and black power movements, Juneteenth resumed its public tenor and gained national resonance, with Coretta Scott King headlining a Washington, D.C. celebration 2 months after her husband's assassination. Today, when 48 states and the District of Columbia officially celebrate Juneteenth, a renewed interest in the holiday dovetails with a similar national reckoning. The post-racial fantasy of the Obama years has given way to a backlash. Blatant attempts at voter suppression, a white nationalist presidency, and the increasingly militant defense of increasingly visible police violence, all signs of the inescapable reality that slavery's legacy continues. Last year on Juneteenth, a meme circulating on social media quipped, "Free-ish since 1865. In On June 19th, Gordon Reed, an East Texas native, confesses to feeling slightly annoyed to discover that people outside Texas celebrate the holiday. For her, the twinge of possessiveness grew from a belief in Texas exceptionalism drummed into natives at birth. Non-Texans could never really understand what the events that took place in Texas actually meant, she writes. Her proprietary attitude passed soon enough. After all, black Texans such as Fort Worth activist Opal Lee have campaigned to make Juneteenth a federal holiday, and Houston Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee reintroduced the Juneteenth National Independence Day Act in February. On Juneteenth provides context for these efforts by recounting the Texas history of Spanish exploration, French and American colonization, African influences, and indigenous cultures that led up to the holiday. No other state brings together so many disparate and defining characteristics all in one, Gordon Reed boasts, as we natives will do. Her academic training tempers that lifelong sense of Texas exceptionalism as she details with clear-eyed detachment yet enduring affection the Lone Star State's outsized impact on the nation. Texas topography is as varied as it is vast. There are the subtropical coastal plains along the Gulf, the steep slopes and plateaus of the hill country, the prairie grass and foothills of the panhandle, and the sprawling urban centers throughout. It's the deserts and plains of the West, though, that occupy the popular imagination. Hollywood depicts Texas as a frontier full of cowboys, rangers, and oil men, with, as Gordon Reed writes, tumbleweeds blowing in the wind. But that landscape is, as she notes, relatively devoid of black people. On Juneteenth pushes back against these stereotypes, taking readers east of the Balcones escarpment to reveal a Texas that our myths have long obscured. East Texas is where slavery first existed in the state, where the Confederacy later reigned, where most black Texans have lived or their ancestors hailed from. As a historian, Gordon Reed has spent her career exploring American families and their stories. In 2008 and 2009, she won a National Book Award and a Pulitzer Prize for The Hemings of Monticello, which offered an in-depth look at a black family on the Thomas Jefferson's plantation. In a series of loosely connected chapters, On Juneteenth sketches Texas' past through Gordon Reed's own family history. In the chapter, A Texas Town, for instance, she describes the post-slavery culture that defined life for generations of black families in her hometown of Conroe, north of Houston and throughout the state. To illustrate the terror required to maintain Jim Crow, she recounts chilling stories of black men lynched or murdered in open court without consequence after being accused of raping white women. Gordon Reed recalls these atrocities not to rehearse the cliché of hysteria surrounding the taboo of black men and white women, but to emphasize black Americans' alternative vision of what had happened, namely that these were often consensual, if clandestine, relationships that were labeled rape only once discovered. Gordon Reed first came to prominence by insisting that scholars and the public take black people's versions of history seriously, no matter how inconvenient they may be. In her 1997 book, Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, An American Controversy, bolstered long-standing black oral histories that claimed that Jefferson fathered his slave Sally Hemings' children. Gordon Reed met with fierce opposition from the historical gatekeepers, but her persistence, DNA evidence, and the documentary record have since overturned the old scholarly consensus, validating both her research and this two centuries old black truth. Recognizing Juneteenth properly, she argues, requires confronting another inconvenient truth, the centrality of slavery to the founding of Texas. Visions of establishing a Western version of Mississippi's cotton plantations prompted Stephen F. Austin, the father of Texas, to tame huge swaths of the Mexican province Cojilla y Tejas, she writes. The soil was rich, the location near the Gulf ideal, but Austin knew any Americans attracted to the venture wouldn't want to work the land themselves. In seventh grade, my classmates and I were taught to view the six flags that have flown over Texas as a point of pride, as a tribute to the gallant men who fought at all costs for Texas independence. The real history presents a sobering counter-narrative, that slavery was the main reason the Texas Project began, that Austin's uneasy alliance with anti-slavery Mexico soon faltered, that the fledgling Republic of Texas joined the United States, and that it succeeded 15 years later with the Confederate States of America. To ignore this reality, Gordon Reed writes, suggests that the lives of African Americans and their descendants in Texas did not and do not matter. A unifying theme in On Juneteenth is the interplay between history and origin stories. History, Gordon Reed writes, chronicles how things have changed over time, with an understanding that those changes were not inevitable. Origin stories, often a mix of memory and myth, tell us what kind of people we believe we are, what kind of nation we believe we live in. The traditional framing of the Juneteenth story has been a bit more myth than history. The naysayers focus on the belatedness, on the fact that General Order No. 3 was announced after the Emancipation Proclamation, after the Civil War, perpetrated caricatures of Southern backwardness and ignorance, thus all the teasing about being late and last. But in fact, prior to Granger's arrival, the gist of the general order had already landed at the wharves of Galveston, a port city that trafficked not only in cotton, but in news from the rest of the world. Word of emancipation soon spread, but the former slaves had to be very wary of open celebration, as whites unleashed a torrent of violence against those who dared rejoice. Once the rebels were subdued and Granger's order pronounced, black Texans, in the face of this hostility, went about the business of making new lives, reuniting with family sold away, attending school, and celebrating Juneteenth come hell or high water, as the Comanche crossing saying goes. Honest history unsettles myth, and in this light, Juneteenth becomes not a marker of ignorance, but a counter-narrative of resilience and resolve. Perhaps the most salient aspect of Granger's order is still the least recognized, Gordon Reed writes. The announcement didn't merely abolish slavery, it mandated absolute equality of personal rights and rights of property between former masters and slaves, completely repudiating cornerstone Confederate principles. Reconstruction scholars in the early 20th century argued that the equality language was mere rhetoric signifying nothing. Given that we have yet to achieve that ideal in Texas or across the nation, one might concede the point. But the beauty of history, Gordon Reed argues, of knowing what didn't happen as well as what did, is that it reminds us of what is yet possible. On Juneteenth ultimately meditates on the double consciousness of being both black and Texan. How, Gordon Reed asks, can black Texans be proud of their home state when the stark reality is that the interest of the men most credited with envisioning Texas and bringing it into being were most often antithetical to black interest and hopes? What does this mean for black Texans thinking of the Texas past? To answer these questions, this consummate historian suggests that we neither remember nor forget the Alamo, but instead remember the people whose boundless dreams of freedom took flight before we were born, before they themselves were free, who taught us to imagine a better future and demand absolute equality despite those who would deny both. Remember Juneteenth. That was the article, The Tangled Meaning of Juneteenth, written by Angela Ards, which was a review of the book On Juneteenth, written by Annette Gordon Reed. This appeared in Texas Monthly Magazine in June 2021. That's all the time we have this week. If you would like to listen to this program again or past editions of the African American Hour, you can find them wherever you get your podcasts or at the Audio Reader website at reader.ku.edu. I'm Byron Buckner, and thank you for listening to the African American Hour.